Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps. Head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Maybe the center leftists are right on the merits about a lot of this stuff, but they seem like they're kind of losing the argument. And the fact that the establishment, which is very unpopular, has been smushed together with the center left, I think is problematic.
All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Argument. My name is Jerusalem Demsis, and today we have something a little bit different for you. We have my normal co-host, Matt Iglesias, with us today. But we also have two guests. One is Jeremiah Johnson, who you know as a staff writer from The Argument, but also from his podcast, the New Liberal Podcast, to which we will also be cross-posting this. I think everyone who listens to our podcast would love Jeremiah's, and you know, I will speak for him and say vice versa as well. But all three of us are got together, and we independently, we're really excited to talk to Nate Silver because he wrote something really great on his Substack, Silver Bulletin, which you should all subscribe to if you are not already subscribed. Nate, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be on. Happy to make this happen.
For sure. So we have four people who like to talk a lot. So we will all attempt to constrain ourselves and fail. And so I'm sure we'll set some records for longest ever podcast today. But you wrote a piece called 12 Questions for the Center Left. And before we get into these questions, like, why did you write this piece? What was the point?
One of the little sub-beats that Silver Bulletin has, I think, is to kind of do anthropology on the Democratic Party, or maybe the broader kind of center and left coalition. You know, I have critiqued establishment liberals in different ways. I have critiqued blue sky liberals in different ways. I've written pieces about how liberal and left, and we'll probably not be strict with this over the podcast, but how liberal and left are not synonyms in quite important ways. But I hadn't really kind of hit the target on like the group that I guess I'm most identified with or self-identified with, which is kind of the center left. And I guess, you know, I mean, Matt writes about this a lot, the frustrations over the electability debate and things like that. But I guess the premise is kind of maybe the center leftists are right on the merits about a lot of this stuff. But they seem like they're kind of losing the argument in a lot of ways. You know, the argument over whether Kamala Harris was a centrist or a left-wing progressive, I mean, I think she's neither exactly, but much closer to a left progressive candidate than a centrist. And the fact that the establishment, which is very unpopular and that, you know, I critique a lot on Silver Bulletin, has been smushed together with the center left, I think is problematic, potentially. It seems like Democrats were once very concerned about electability. And, you know, there's still a lot of bounds on that, right? The fact that El Sayed won in Michigan, but Francesca Hong didn't win in Wisconsin, like, that's an interesting differentiator, right? They're both pretty far left. I would say El Sayed has some appealing qualities. If you look at, you know, I think he's an articulate, accomplished, smart guy with who's a good politician, whereas Hong was a very awkward fit for anything involving electoral politics. But yeah, we're going to be hearing these debates over and over again. I mean, the 2028 primary will start on November 4th, the day after the midterm. And so I want to kind of probe at things that I think were a bit contradictory, maybe. In part because what the center left is not all that easy to define either.
Are the vibes, okay, Matt, Jeremiah, do you guys think the vibes are bad with center left? It sounds like Nate feels like vibes are quite bad.
My vibes are excellent. They're doing amazing. No, I mean, look, and this is running through sort of Nate's commentary, right? But clearly, like, a number of establishment Democratic figures have been losing to this sort of insurgent left forces. And I think, like, one question that, you know, like, my readers, the people who, you know, agree with me, affiliate with Slow Boring, et cetera, have to ask themselves is, like, how sad are we about a Diana DeGette losing a primary to a Melet Kyros? Because DeGette herself is like really left wing and like much more left wing than I am or than I would advocate the Democrats become. And yet it is true that like I see my like factional enemies like being thrilled on Twitter and like I feel depressed. And then I have to be like, well, but like, is that like actually what I think? Or am I excited about Bobby Pulido running in Texas 15, up in polls? I think reflecting like my idea of how politics should be practiced. And when I'm in that mindset, I'm like, you know what? Like there's a number of races where candidates who I really like seem to be doing well, who I think themselves are like breaking from the establishment. And I wish I could get some more attention to them. And the problem is like they don't represent New York City. Right. And like everything that happens in New York is amplified 100x. But like there's no real reason electorally that like New York shouldn't have like young, charismatic leftists. Like it's just a very left wing city. But then it's like, well, why is the discourse so dominated by that? Like, does it matter like who has like backbench house seats from Brooklyn, you know, like looms very large in the minds of like people, like writers who live in Brooklyn, but doesn't seem actually important to the future of the country. And that's how I like talk myself into a better vibe. but then we have the 2028 primary looming. And, you know, these things are always like really high stakes. And I don't feel like it's going that well for people, ideas that I agree with.
Yeah, I would say it depends just where you look. Look, like if you are defining the center left by their foreign policy views and, you know, The obvious Israel-Gaza debate has, you know, gone very strongly in one direction. Pro-Israel Democrats are really going through it right now. And if that's your definition of the center left, then yeah, you're pretty despondent about the direction of the party right now. If you are defining the center left by how many YIMBY wins we've gotten recently, you know, I think the YIMBY movement continues to rack up wins. There's reason for optimism there. If you're looking at New York City, yeah, the few remaining moderates in New York City don't seem to be having a great time. But if you look at the Senate races in a bunch of key places, whether it's Alaska, you know, with Peltola, whether it's Roy Cooper in North Carolina, whether it's Texas, whether it's Iowa, there's a number of reasons to think like, yeah, the moderate candidates in a lot of these places or the center left candidates, whatever terminology you'd like to use, they still have a lot of juice. This is still the pathway to an actual Democratic majority. And these things come in waves. You know, part of this, part of how I think about this is it's clear that like the Democratic Socialist and the capital L left is having a moment, but those moments never last forever. And while this moment is happening, can the center left regroup, build infrastructure, and be ready to take advantage of the inevitable moment when the left stumbles and, you know, there's a opportunity for the center left to kind of step in?
So, I mean, your first question of your four questions is about the relationship between liberalism and centrism. So you ask, like, should the center left explicitly avow liberalism as opposed to centrism, moderation, or compromise? So I wrote this piece for The Argument a while back about there's called Why I'm Not a Centrist, which is basically about kind of drawing the distinction between liberalism and centrism. And my point is that if you are like an avowed liberal, people who are liberal, you know, believe a wide range of things, but they're often like actually, they're like a lot of very radical things that modern liberals really believe that are not like centrist. Like I think that like, you know, Matt, you've written about this too, but like if you take like YIMBYism seriously as an economic project, it's like a radical remaking of like the entire country. It's like, it's not at all like something that you could categorize as moderate or even compromise. Like to me, like centrism has largely been like a tactic that people can use in different points in order to like enact an agenda. So, you know, for instance, like YIMBYs do not say when they're trying to upzone, you know, Nashville, like, hey, like we actually don't believe that any, you know, of these regulations are legitimate unless they have to do with health and safety. They go like, what's wrong with a townhouse? Like what's wrong with a smaller single family home? Because that's how you like win political fights with people, is by meeting them halfway. But to me, it's like, you know, it's hard because when we talk about the center left, like often I think what we're talking about is like actually a very diverse group of people who don't enjoy like the extremism in some form or fashion. Sometimes it might be like super far left on social issues, but are also, a, you know, really I don't know, aware of how economics works. And so they don't sign on to some of the more insane left econ ideas. Sometimes it means that they're like actually super centrist on social issues, but they have like very far left views on economic populism or whatever it is. And like, it's not actually to me like a super concrete group of people, which I find very difficult to like then think about, like, who are we talking about?
Yeah, there is a real energy gap. If you look at surveys of all Americans, there are a lot of people who are moderate or centrist, and I'm happy to parse those terms and the difference between that and center left and liberal and all these things are different. But they tend to be less activated. It's a bit like herding cats. I mean, inherently kind of both the strength and the weakness of liberalism, as I understand it, or one of the strengths, is that it is a system based in some ways on tolerance and saying, okay, we people of radically different views come from all ethnic backgrounds and religious backgrounds in the United States and have different incentives. And how do we all get along? You know, I live in the middle of Manhattan, and just the complexity of activity in the city when you're ducking taxi cabs. And, you know, it's kind of amazing to me that there's not anarchy in some ways, right? We've built all these skyscrapers and have this highly functioning subway system. I'm a big defender of New York City things in general. You know, one of the tensions I think is there's kind of maybe a faction of liberalism that you might call a kind of big government do-gooder types, right? They want government to be a bit more empirical and rational, maybe a bit more utilitarian in some ways, kind of the technocrats. Then there might be a more libertarian strain, people who are concerned about the accumulation of power in general. And, you know, I might say the one form of this is to be as concerned about the accumulation of government power and corporate power, and maybe even a little bit concerned about groupthink and kind of cultural and institutional power. And that kind of veers toward a kind of bleeding heart libertarian side a little bit. And that's a tension. That's a tension you see, I think, within the center left. You see it in like the abundance movement a little bit. I love Derek and Ezra. I reviewed their book. But it's not quite clear what they think the role is for like the public sector versus the private sector. I mean, we can all agree that we want a more effective public sector. And, you know, Zoran Mamdani has a high approval rating in New York, in part because he cares about like the little shit, right? When the Knicks win, he gives like an actually good speech about the Knicks. And, you know, there's lots of helpful, you know, little things that people notice about like cutting down on turnstile jumping in the subway, right? And he seems to give a shit, and that matters a lot, and has been a successful governing ideology for the left, talking about like sewer socialism and things like that. But yeah, it's really you know, I get annoyed when you hear people like Hassan Piker, I've heard say, for example, like, oh, the centrists don't really believe in anything. And like, no, actually, like liberalism is a fairly coherent ideology. Now, not all centrists are liberals and vice versa, but there is like connective tissue between all these things.
But also, I think the relationship between these ideas, right, of like liberalism as an ideology and sort of centrist politics in the contemporary United States of America is this idea of like pluralism of ideas and of ideology. Like you were being complimentary to aspects of Mamdani's governance, which I think is very typical of center-left people who don't necessarily agree with him about everything, but see some good in what he is doing and want to foster that and like drag it out, right? Versus there is a rhetorical mode of left politics in which all disagreement is immediately attributed to corruption, right? And it's like they don't believe in the possibility of sincere disagreement. From which, and that's like an ideological principle of left politics, from which it follows that like you don't really believe in compromise, that you don't really believe in like the median voter differs from place to place. And so we would expect different kinds of people to win there. It follows like a concept of like, how are we going to make change in the United States is, well, we're going to define Medicare for all in like very grandiose terms. And then we're going to win as much power as we can. And we're going to just kind of like jam it through, right? Like you don't want to say, look, there's a lot of different countries that have a lot of different healthcare systems. Most of them are more universal than America's, but they all face these kind of fundamental problems of resource allocation and like, how do you constrain it and how do you balance current consumption against the future, blah, 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 blah. And so it's like, it's very liberal to get into these on the one hand, on the other hand, sort of centrist complexities about the world, which is just different from the liberalism that you might have found in the 1870s, where you're just like, no, like we can't just have the king make all the, right? Like that was a very extreme view at that time. But we have landed in Western democracies in a place where I think liberalism is kind of tied to the idea of like holding the center together, that there's going to be all these disparate people who have their kind of kooky notions, and we need to do some brokerage and some reasoning and some peaceful collaboration rather than think we're going to have a totalizing victory. Because that's where we are historically, right? Like America has this liberal tradition that is being a little bit torn asunder by a kind of like a MAGA right and a socialist left. And not to say there are no ideas on which like I would like to see large changes, but I don't envision like the final victory. And then politics will end because we've defeated the corrupt bad guys out there. Like it's just going to be some more shit.
Yeah, I think it's worth remembering that in like European parliamentary systems where you have like an explicitly center left slash liberal party, like Liberal Democrats in the UK, they might get 12, 14, 15% of the vote and they rarely win or control power outright. They kind of have to be coalition partners. Now it is complicated because, you know, in some liberal ideas like free speech are extremely popular and in some ways kind of liberalism won over much of the Western world in the 20th century. So it's a big, powerful institution unto itself. But yeah, look, you know, maybe it's also partly because I like study public opinion, but you know, I actually tend to give some deference to public opinion, right? When you're betting on sports or when you're doing anything where there's a market competition element, then you learn that the market is usually pretty smart. Some people describe it as a kind of super intelligence, non-AI related of its own. And so, yeah, like, you know, I think if you took the median voter, you would find some contradictions. You would find a situation where they simultaneously want to cut the debt and lower taxes and spend way more money on some things. But like overall, I think their instincts tend to be pretty reasonable for the most part. And people draw, you can disagree with the lines, but they draw sophisticated lines on issues like gender identity that say, yeah, we want to give people freedom, but when it involves minors and things like that, then okay, it gets more complicated and things like that. You know, there's interesting things, man. You know, people, voters, if you look at surveys, were always kind of convinced that like COVID more likely than not had a laboratory origin, which is now becoming a more acceptable viewpoint, right? In kind of mainstream liberal discourse a little bit, despite the near hegemony of like the liberal progressive media establishment saying, no, this could have happened, it came from, you know, animal spillover and things like that. But like, I think public opinion is often pretty smart with lots and lots of caveats. But like, yeah, the notion, both the left and the right, although not just left and the right. I mean, the Democratic establishment has its own version of this that I'll get to in a moment. But yeah, they're both convinced that like, well, either a silent majority really believes what I believe, and or they were fooled or tricked by the media, by immigrants flooding into the polling stations, right? And they're not willing to admit that like people have differences of opinion that are legitimate. In some cases, or if not, are very entrenched and to some degree, like sincerely felt, right? The the critique I have of the establishment kind of resistance libs is now they kind of blame everything on like the media and the wrong New York Times headline. You know, I thought the Biden debate a couple of years ago was, should have been a big epistemic break where it's like, okay, if you were saying that, that the media fixation on Biden's age was just kind of a fake thing, then that debate ought to have disabused you of that notion. But, you know, I'm not sure if they're that much better. I mean, you know, I have, having had forecasts in different years that show Democrats ahead some years, Republicans ahead some years, I have fought with every group. And by no means do I think the left has a monopoly on this kind of like reality disfigurement syndrome.
I want to draw lines between a couple of the things that were said right here, because I think there's something important about how, you know, Matt described in the 1870s, liberalism was a much more radical ideology. You were forced in the moment to actually defend the core liberal principles a lot more explicitly. And Nate talked about how, you know, liberalism is the great winner of the 20th century. We kind of swim in the waters of liberalism right now, to the extent that for much of my lifetime, politicians on either side of the aisle have not had to make a case for liberalism because it is just the water in which we swim. It's where we live. And I think that's changing now. And I think that there's something to be said about liberalism as a political strategy and not just an ideology. Because I think, Jerusalem, you mentioned this at the very beginning, that like centrism can sometimes be seen as, you know, more a political tactic. I'm going to moderate strategically on this one issue, whereas liberalism is a little bit more of an ideology. And I think that's right. But I also think that too much of that leads to, you know, disenchantment with the entire liberal project, because nobody is making the affirmative case for liberalism. When Hassan Piker says, well, centrists don't believe in anything, there's an element of truth to that for some of the centrists. There's a version of a Democratic centrist who essentially says, well, you know, Bernie Sanders goes too far, but I'd like to do about 40% of what Bernie Sanders wants. And like, that's not ever going to inspire anyone. It's not going to get people's blood pumping. It's not going to get volunteers for your movement. It's not going to get people knocking on doors. If you think about, you know, the gigantic gap that has opened up on a local organizing level, I think that's part of the reason, is that, you know, these moment by moment strategic moderation decisions, they may make sense in that moment, but they leave a gap where you are not claiming any real political ground. You are leaving your opponents on the far left or the far right to be the ones who say, well, we have principles and you don't. And I think that there's actually a kind of meta strategy where it's important to actually claim the ground that like liberalism is its own distinct political philosophy. You know, we have hundreds of years of talking about this, of the core principles, and it's important to claim that ground and defend it. I think this moment may actually be a good opportunity for that, given that these core values of liberalism are very directly under threat. And so, you know, there's a lot more of an opportunity than there was, say, during, you know, a Bill Clinton versus H.W. Bush kind of election.
But I think the problem here is that, like, there actually are loads of centrists who are not liberals. And I know, like, that's kind of like been alluded to, but it's just like, if you look at a lot of, for instance, immigration policy, like there's a lot of centrism that you can have, the immigration policy, which is basically just like, is very, very illiberal. That's just basically like, I don't actually care about any kind of procedural rights for anyone. There's like, I don't care about like free movement of people. I don't really care like that. Like, and there's ways to moderate that I think are very liberal. But I think that there's a lot of the rhetoric and policy ideas that have come out of centrist Democratic wing have been super, super liberal. So when I think about, like, you know, where the central of the Democratic Party is, you often don't see a lot of them having like, oh, I have a core liberal ideology and that I'm now doing tactical moderation because of the world that we live in. You just see people who are like, I mean, and again, I think this is true across the aisle, but like across the political spectrum, they're just like, you know, they're doing a job. They're politicians. They have some issues they care about, but they're not like super ideological, just like most people in the world are not super ideological. And then they're trying to figure out where the ball is going, and it's confusing. And I'll say this here, like, I just also don't think that it's that unique to the center left or to you know, the Democrats either, that, you know, they see that they will often talk about doing 50% of what they want to do. Like, a distinguishing fact of the left is that they are constantly talking about the fact that they have like much larger aspirations, but the goal is to like get there gradually. Even when you look at Abdul El-Sayed, him kind of moderating on Medicare for All, like I'll talk to some people who are, you know, really big El-Sayed supporters, and they'll say things like, well, yes, he's like saying this more moderate version of Medicare for All in order to get elected. And then, but we know and trust that he actually really does want to do this really, really more maximalist version. And that's why we support him. And that's like a very rational thing to do. But I don't, and so I think like there's like this, like, you know, Jeremiah, you kind of pointed out this Piker critique of the centrists, which says that like they're the ones who don't believe in anything. But I think that's actually like really just only opportunistically levied at people by their enemies when everyone is basically doing this.
Okay, let's take a break, and then I want to connect this to sort of the second question.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Okay, so we're back. So the second question on Nate's list was about the relationship of the center-left to the establishment. And this is where I think we're like in a sort of a weird situation, right? Because I think to not believe in anything is almost like the essence of being a political party establishment. Like that's what it's for. The establishment is the people who are in charge, and they just try to stay in charge and they try to win elections. And that's like part of the American system because we only have two parties, right? If this is the Netherlands, you have 13 parties and like party leaders are supposed to be ideologues, but we've only got two. So the establishment is, they're establishmentarians. But normally, you know, if an establishment will get overthrown, like by Ronald Reagan in 1980. And then a new establishment is formed. And then Trump overthrew the Republican establishment. And now there's a new establishment that is formed and reconciled around him, some of the same people, some old people, et cetera. The Democratic establishment since 2016 keeps holding on to command of the party, but not winning the argument. You know, so that, you know, if Hillary Clinton had beat Bernie and then won the election, maybe we just have an establishment era, but she lost. But then the establishment made a comeback with Biden. But then Biden seemed to like cede a lot of ground to the left in his governance. He was a very weak leader. He turned out to be too aged. He got all these people to vouch for him. That was proven to be hollow. But then they passed off leadership to Kamala Harris, and then she lost. And now we've got Chuck Schumer, who like, I remember Chuck Schumer's 1998 Senate campaign, and he was already a veteran House member then. And so you have this incredible continuity of personnel. Well, there's been a lot of change in Democrats' issue positions since like the heyday of Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden as 1990s legislators. And it's like a confusing situation where instead of the establishment being overthrown by a new group of people who then need to reconcile themselves to the realities of electoral politics, you have the establishment not being overthrown, but constantly trying to accommodate the ideas of the insurgent left. And it's created this situation that just like genuinely nobody is happy with. Like I can come to all these mod happy hours and everybody's mad and it's like, you're not doing what we want. But then all the leftists hate the people who are in charge. And like, I'll have very friendly conversations with Chuck Schumer, with Hakeem Jeffries. And they'll be like, you're so great. We love Slow Boring. And I'm like, but do you? Like, you're not doing what I want. And it's like, it's an establishment that gets criticized a lot for its failures, but that I think is almost like succeeded too much in holding on to power when like it just needs to you just need some different people. And then we can have an argument about like what they should do.
One thing we look at in our model is just party unity scores for individual members of Congress. Mm. Susan Collins might have like actually only a 50% party unity score, or Jared Golden might be only 50% or 60%. It's not exactly ideology, but it's one of the more tangible measures of moderation like quality. And it correlates in lots of historical data with overperformance. But if you look at those scores, they're all just collapsed down for both parties. And actually even more so for Democrats. This is a long-winded way of saying, like, you know, Democrats behave with remarkable unity with these narrow majorities in 2021 and 2022 to pass a fair amount of consequential legislation. They have been nearly unanimous in opposing Trump on nearly everything throughout each of Trump's two terms, you know, and the establishment got its way with presidential picks. I put 2016 in a different category. Bernie and Hillary had a long, drawn-out contest. I think superdelegates are kind of stupid to declare their allegiance in advance, but she won that in a 50-state fight fair and square. There was a really big finger put on the scale, thumb on the scale for Biden in 2020. In 2024, Kamala Harris was chosen essentially without any direct input from voters. And she's not somebody who had, I don't know what the alternate, you know, John Edwards or somebody at least had won a few primaries and demonstrated some popular support, whereas she had aggressively failed despite high expectations from many other people. And she's a very talented person when she ran in the primary in 2020. And so, you know, you kind of got what you want, right? You had a lot of maybe not party unity in the way people argue on Twitter, but party unity as far as like the results. And now you're paying that down that debt that you've accumulated a little bit is part of how I see it.
I feel like this relationship with the establishment is one of the biggest sticking points for both like center leftists, but also just like liberals in general. And I think it's like very, very difficult for the center left to disavow the establishment because they're also very concerned with shoring up the party as like a strong institution. And so there's like a lot of effort to like both like, okay, well, we want to keep this as like, you know, an institution that can, you know, keep out radicalization, but also actually be effective at like beating Republicans. And at the same time, like they don't want to be held responsible for establishment failures, which are, you know, can be distributed across the spectrum, whether it's like now everyone's doing the woke one was crazy thing. That was like an establishment view. And like, it's like hard to understand then like what we're talking about, because if the establishment was like the woke one was crazy people, and they're also the people who are now disavowing the establishment, it like, it's really confusing. And like at this point, like AOC, right? Like she is obviously an incredibly, you know, anti-establishment figure in a lot of respects, but she's also someone who's constantly criticizing the establishment, and like Bernie Sanders, anti-establishment, Elizabeth Warren. But these are people who had tremendous amounts of power, not just in Congress, but like in the Biden administration when it comes to staffing, et cetera. And so in some ways, like I think that like the word establishment has just become like completely synonymous with a type of like moderation politics that is like irrelevant from the question of like whether or not you hold power. And it's sometimes I think like in these conversations, we can get like overly literal about stuff. And it's like who is the establishment? Like has like some sort of like meaning that we can derive from like the way people use words or whatever. But I actually think it like it's almost like not full of content outside of moderate means establishment means you are a moderate. And so I think you can't escape it if you're a moderate Democrat.
I mean, I think one thing that's important to keep in mind here is that by far the most important thing in electoral politics, I think, for the last 10 years has been to be against the current state of things. This is a very like Martin Gurry-pilled kind of revolt of the public take, but to be against whatever is happening right now is just the most potent electoral politics you can possibly have. And this is from the right, from the left, from anywhere. You just have to be angry. You have to be authentically enraged and fed up about the current state of things. And that's why you see both the right and the left kind of catastrophizing about the state of the country, you know, when objectively, you know, we have a lot of problems, but America's doing pretty well, especially if you look at like how well we recovered from COVID compared to other countries, you know, how well we're innovating in key technological areas, et cetera, economic growth. But everybody believes everything is falling apart all the time, forever. And so this has even begun, as Jerusalem noted, to infect the establishment itself, where they are also trying to get in on the game of criticizing the establishment, even if they are the establishment. I'm not sure how you get around this paradox, but it just seems to be the defining feature of modern politics that you have to be angry at whoever is in charge, at whatever the current order of things is. And, you know, I think the center left has to get in on that, or they're just going to be left behind.
You don't seem that angry, though.
Yeah, Jeremiah, you're too happy. I mean, I do think there's like, I mean, this feeds really well into your fourth question, actually, Nate, which is, what is the center left's view on how capitalism is going?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that like part of the thing that's difficult is that like liberals want to, I don't know, I want to do like a victory lap for like everything that fucking happened over the past, like not everything, sorry. The liberals want to do a victory lap for like the economic outcomes of the past like 60, 70 years and the amount of people that were pulled out of poverty, the amount of technological innovation that occurred. And like, this is not to say that like things can't get better,
and
but
the
like,
social progress too. Let's not forget that.
Totally. Yeah. And like, you know, like the expansions of rights, etc. And it's one of those really weird things where, you know, Matt and I were talking about this the other day, but like someone saying something positive that's happening in the world immediately gets dogpiled. Someone had tweeted out that like the number of people living on under $1 a day had like, you know, we had achieved a bunch of progress there. And then, I don't know, Matt got really mad because someone else was angry that like, well, actually
no, there
progress-
was David Wallace Wells was like, well, the number of people living on less than $30 a day has barely budged. It was like, well, I mean, that's 30 times one. Like, it's a much higher number. Of course, there's been less. I don't know.
No, I think one of the facts that the American education system, I think, doesn't do a good enough job of pounding into people is that like the world has made a tremendous amount of progress. I'm kind of slowly working my way through, I think Robert Gordon is the historian or economist who writes these very dense books, right? But it's about like, and he's actually arguing that like there has been some stagnation since roughly 1970.
He thinks it's over.
But if you go back 100 years, like life was literally shitty. There was literally horse shit everywhere in major cities like New York, and working conditions were terrible, and there was child labor. You know, to the extent possible, we can discern this. It seems like people were subjectively quite unhappy and miserable in lots of ways, and that comes out in like the literature and the art of the time in various ways. And again, the debate since the 70s is much more interesting. The peak of world GDP growth actually peaked in like 1974 or something and has stagnated somewhat since then. And I think there are good arguments about like, you know, on the one hand, you go to Europe and you say, okay, well, gosh, there's only 0.5% GDP growth per year. You know, you go to some cities like Rome and they look the same as they did in 1999. On the other hand, you go to Paris, right? And it's like, okay, Paris, now the Seine is beautiful. You can go running there, right? There's a bit less smoking outside, although still quite a bit, right? You can get, you know, it's become more friendly to tourists. It's still, and I'm like, okay, I'll take, and they live till 84 years old. Americans live till 78, 79. You're like, I'll take this, man. Yeah. Maybe I'll take 0.5% growth instead of 2% growth if I can have that quality of life. But still, you know, for people not to recognize that millions of people, billions, I mean, around the world have been lifted out of poverty and misery in many ways, like just recognizing that as like a core historical fact about the world would go some way toward
because libs just can't take the win. I think the part of the problem here is that this like effusive need to constantly qualify stuff that people are saying. I mean, and again, in many ways, if everyone was like this, it would be really good quality. Like if everyone, whenever they said something, they were like, to be sure, four or six qualifications. I mean, that would be a great world if everyone could then have like reasoned dialogue about like what to do and which of these costs outweighed which of these benefits or whatever. But instead, we live in a world where like liberals are constantly like, yes, I know that like, you know, we've done really well to lift out billions of people out of poverty, but we can never forget the fact that all these other things are going wrong. And there's never any kind of like triumphalism that is like displayed. I don't want to say never, but I think there's not an aura of triumphalism. Whereas like other ideologies, no matter how much they have failed, I mean, there are like communists, there are like Nazis like on Twitter whose like ideology has been like totally debunked, and the triumphalism that they will display is like absolutely mind-boggling. But it is like a problem, because like, if you're like temperamentally like moderate and then you are in a moment where people are wanting dramatic change and you are unable to even like champion your own wins, like I think that's a huge problem.
A liberal is someone who's too fair-minded to take his own side in a fight. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. But I've got kind of a geopolitical interpretation of this, which is that, you know, I'm old, and Nate probably remembers this too. But, you know, the late Clinton years, when they were debating permanent normal trade relations with China, the thing that centrist liberals were saying back then was that China's integration into the global market was going to create not just economic growth, but peace and political change in China, right? And I think that if that had happened, if you had the exact GDP trends that have happened in the world, the exact same decline in global poverty, the exact same, the decline in global poverty isn't just China, but it is majority China and a lot of neighboring Asian countries, and China had become democratic and like Russian democracy had entrenched itself the way the Clinton administration thought, then I think liberals would be telling you this very uncomplicated triumphalist story. And then other people would be saying, oh, but there's still so much poverty, you know, in Nigeria or whatever. But we'd be saying, yeah, but like liberalism has the solution to poverty. Like, we solved poverty in China. We are solving it in India. We solved it in Vietnam and Cambodia. And it's just got to come to Kenya, to Botswana.
Yeah, but like, liberals has to fix everything? Like,
No. But I'm just saying, we're left with, oh, we have all these positive economic trends. But what the positive economic trends amount to is that, like, America's stature in the world has suffered relative decline. Compared to this authoritarian country where they have like pictures of Mao on the and we're like heading toward just like a situation that doesn't generate actually very good vibes, you know? And I think that sort of halo effect around China has supercharged a certain amount of like leftist economic thinking in a way that doesn't totally make sense. I think that it's supercharged a kind of nationalist thinking on the right because we're in a climate of increasing geopolitical threat. And so that we're like in this, even though like normal people don't think or care about foreign policy at all, elite people think or care about it quite a lot. It's why Israel drives a lot of factional politics. And I think that it is seen that like the globalization project was a failure, not because the economics of it failed, but because this larger geopolitical pitch around it like genuinely hasn't worked out. And it's left us all a little bit adrift where we're like, on the one hand, and like, yeah, this is good. There's a lot less poverty, but like, does China having like supersonic missiles and giant robot like, do we feel good about that trend? Is that good for the cause of liberalism globally? Or like, are we about to be plowed under?
And Russia, I'd mention too, right? As far as, yeah, two big post-war failures. Although China's a weird case. I've never been to China apart from Hong Kong. I mean, maybe I need to.
That's a very controversial statement.
But friends who have gone are like, China has a very entrepreneurial capitalistic spirit, right? And in some ways it feels very free. You just cannot criticize the government under any circumstances. And that's a very strict rule. Like, I don't know, you know, if Singapore is a paradise because you can't chew gum there or something, maybe it's worth it. And like, but like that is a more paradigmatic challenge. An alternative is succeeding in some ways, whereas Russia's just like, I don't know, man, you're getting a weird cultural shit, but maybe there are religious or cultural underpinnings or geographic underpinnings. I'm always fascinated by the geography of places and how that correlates to their systems of government, right? You know, maybe liberalism isn't some universal system.
I mean, the arguments about geography or culture are always a little strange to me because we have such clean examples where culture doesn't matter. You know, we have a thriving, rich Chinese democracy. It's called Taiwan. And, you know, we could if the North Koreans had won the Korean War, let's say they drive America out entirely, maybe we come up with this theory that, well, you know, East Asian countries simply aren't suited for democracy. Look at China. Look at unified North Korea. But the thing is, they didn't win. And now we have, you know, two identical cultures where one of them became a totalitarian nightmare juice state. And one of them is, again, now after some road bumps, a thriving liberal capitalist democracy. You can look at the same thing with Russia, where a country, Ukraine, which is not to insult Ukrainians, but for most of its history, kind of pseudo Russia. Again, they are turning towards Europe.
That's a hot take.
They're as close to Russia as you can get without. And for a long time, Ukrainians and Russians considered themselves brothers. You know, we are cousins, and it's actually very sad that the war has basically put an end to that forever for generations. But they are turning towards Europe. They want to be a liberal capitalist democracy. And so, like, I'm just always skeptical of the idea that, like, any of these cultural arguments are ever really permanent when we have so many clean splits of, like, you can draw a line down the middle of a country and one half will become liberal and the other half will remain authoritarian, even though it's the same people.
I mean, I think these are all, I mean, I think the international points are, you know, well taken, but I do think that this has a lot more to the vibe that people are feeling right now that is negative. It's a lot more to do with domestic politics than it does with international ones. I had, you know, a while back I interviewed this economist at Harvard who had written this paper that showed that if you grew up under like kind of zero sum economic conditions, and that is like if you grew up in like a low growth economy, that you were much more likely to espouse like zero sum views about the world, and like that there was like a real durable impact of having, you know, even grandparents who had grown up in slavery or something like that would affect your kind of view of zero sum politics today. And, you know, you don't want to take this too far, but I just do think that at some level here, like, the fact that people don't view the changes that have existed in their lifetime as having turbocharged their quality of life, like, matters a ton. Like, the changes that people have experienced in their lifetimes, if you're like under 40 years old, are largely like in the digital world, right? You haven't seen like, wow, like now we have these like really cool trains and we've redone the entirety of like the urban infrastructure to make it more efficient and convenient.
We have all these great podcasts.
We have all these great podcasts now.
Podcast abundance.
Exactly. And I do think that that plays a large role in what's going on here, that like it's not like a tangible delivery in the same way that in some countries, you know, growth is like, wow, like we didn't used to have like a paved road and now we have like a paved road here and I can now access all these other consumer goods, whether it's a car or bicycles or whatever it is. And so to me, I mean when I'm thinking of this challenge, like what does the center left or what do liberals do about like capitalism, is that it's actually quite hard to imagine reviving a non-economic populist view of the of economics in the country if you can't make that different. That's why I think abundance is so important, is that like you need people to feel that changes in their environment are happening for the better, and it needs to feel like tangible.
I think there's an aspect of this. I think you're right, Jerusalem, that like people don't feel the rise of the internet as much as they did, you know, in the Robert Gordon sense, the rise of indoor plumbing, which was like a revolutionary thing to have. The internet doesn't feel like this. But I do think there's also a case of like the dog that doesn't bark here, that you don't appreciate, you know, something that is now missing that's good. Where when I think about some of the greatest changes we've had and the most beneficial changes we've had in the last 30 to 40 years, say from the early 90s to right now, it's that the murder rate has come down by like 80% or something like that. It's that Los Angeles is no longer choked with smog, that we don't have acid rain anymore. But it's much harder to appreciate the dog that doesn't bark, the things that are now missing, as opposed to a big shiny train and infrastructure project, things like that.
So I think we skipped a little bit over Nate's question three, which was about sort of center-left's relationship to anger, although Jeremiah mentioned it. And this is just one that I struggle with a lot. Like, analytically, I just think clearly, like, expressing angry affect is good. You know, it's like good politics. It's working well for people. And I could sit there and I could say, from the perspective of things that I think, there should be more anger in a moderate sense, just directed at the way Joe Biden handled the border situation. And there should be more anger at the way the left sort of like steered economic policy in the Biden years. And then it's kind of like pretended that they didn't. And that the YIMBY movement is like, we want to address the biggest flaw facing people in the economy with a market-based reform. And like, that can be like an angry, whatever kind of thing. I'm just like not an angry person. I, in college, was like sentenced to anger management classes after some personal misconduct on my part. And I've like gone through extensive efforts to like try to not be an angry person and like do my cognitive behavioral therapy. And it's like, sure, like there are things that I don't like about the status quo, but like, is being angry, like, how does that help? And I'm like, you know, like I've convinced myself to like not be a rageful person. And I see all the time people on the internet acting out. And I'm like, I want them to get some therapy. Not because I think that all their problems are fake, but that because, like, I really don't think that this angry ideation is helpful. I think that over the past 10 years of, like, let's do more performative anger in our politics, it has not led to outcomes that are causing people to become less angry. And I remember when Obama was president, there was like a big take on like the broads and not like the left. Like everyone in Democratic Party politics was like, well, it would be better if the president could like channel the anger that people are feeling at the bankers. And like, I sort of agree with that like maybe one of the conditions of TARP should have been that like you just get to like punch Jamie Dimon in the face.
Tar and feather, maybe.
And say like, fuck you, man. But also like... I see it like Obama's way, or I remember, what was his name? The Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner. And he was like, you know, I could like be really mad, but I think that what we actually need is a financial market recovery and for people to have jobs. And it's not like constructive for us to be like ranting and raving in that kind of sense. And so I just like, I feel really torn around that.
Nate, are people angrier now? Is there polling on this? Like, are people like, not like, you know, elites or whatever, but like are regular people just madder now?
I think that's pretty robust and safe to say, right? If you ask people how things are going in the United States, those numbers have been very low for many years. If you ask them about like trust in institutions, those numbers have been low for many years. There is, by the way, a generational component. I mean, Matt and I think are about the same age, right? If you're roughly speaking in your 40s now, people talk about how like when whatever music you like when you were 12 to 16, right? Mm-hmm. Like the politics, when we were like 12 to 16 were fucking great, right? The US wins the Cold War and the Berlin Wall falls, right? And the economy is really good, at least in the Clinton years for the most part. So we're like, that shit was good, right? That was the right way of doing things. And now all these kind of people get in the way. But like, that's very different if your formative political experience is September 11th or the wars that followed it or that pandemic or the financial crisis, right? Whereas like for Matt and I, maybe that's the deviation from the good, the way things were. The
right. It's like we've got 25 years of deviation after like our 5 years of how things should be in the late 90s. And that's maybe a little blinkered.
So I mean, one of my big questions for you, Nate, is like, what happened to the center right? And like, does that actually exist? And like, what does that actually mean now in politics? Because there's this big debate happening right now on the right where you have some of these more, I would say, like economically liberal conservatives who are really going after J.D. Vance. I mean, one of them is Phil Magnus, who's an economist who writes for us, but there are also like a bunch more of them who are really coming for Vance after he had a, you know, some comments about how the dollar should no longer be the reserve currency of the United States. He's also made some other comments about like GDP not being that important, et cetera. And so like, this is a group of people which, you know, like a lot of the new right would like to characterize as like the dying wing, like the Bush Reaganite wing of the party, which they view as like in the past. And it's hard for me to tell, like, is that true? Like, is the kind of sentiment gone? Because like, when I look at like state politics, right, like the Chamber of Commerce matters a lot. Like, you know what I mean? Like, when you're like, there are conservatives doing like anti-regulation stuff in their states all over the place. They're doing like, quote unquote, normie Bush Reagan policy to allow a bunch of energy to be developed in Texas, even though they are hostile to clean energy. They still let a ton of solar exist. You know what I mean? So like, is the electorate really done with center-right politics?
I mean, look, I think the baseline explanation is that the center-right had a hell of a time with Trump. With Trump being very much not a coalition builder, or at least not a reliable coalition builder. And so you're kind of either with him and you become MAGA, or you're against him and you join the bulwark or something like that, right? I do think kind of, you know, the lack of a lot of center right media channels is kind of interesting too. I mean, kind of the Wall Street Journal, kind of the,
but now they're AI.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Kind of the New York Post. The New York Post has like a little bit more of occasional centrist sensibility on some things and is Fox News on other things. But that space has kind of been abandoned by, I don't know. Yeah. Probably starting a center right media company that doesn't just become like resistance libs would be interesting.
Isn't that the Free Press?
The Dispatch, arguably.
We kind of the Dispatch more than the other ones. The Free Press, whom I like in some ways and critique in other ways, right? Like this is one of the danger for the center left, right? Is that I don't think the center left wants to be captured by any one issue. You don't want the center left to be like people who are liberals, but really mad about girls, trans girls in sports or trans boys in sports or whatever, right? Like that's polarizing.
Is anyone mad about trans boys in sports? I'm always wondering for a single person to give a shit about this.
No.
But you don't want co-option by kind of single issue voters. I mean, what probably happens is like, you know, super pro Israel Democrats just wind up becoming Republicans because there's no way station necessarily. I don't know that the center left wants to be that way station because it's, you know, movements are very easily captured by people who, you know, people are incredibly passionate on all sides of the Israel Gaza debate. And I, you know, my heart goes out to them in some ways. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think liberals have always had an issue too of because they are a little bit more reluctant to like police dissent in some ways, then the most irritating people can kind of get a veto over everything else, right? This is a lot of the problem, I think, with like academia. You know, I'll go and give talks or do interviews at academic institutions a few times a year, and those experiences are always great. To me, the students seem just as bright as ever, and the professors seem mostly sane, right? But like, if the 80% of professors who are sane aren't willing to, you know, censure in some ways, not S-C-N-C-O-R, but like, but, you know, push back on the 20% of crazy professors, then that, you know, can abandon all of academia. And then you also have silent exit. Like one thing in New York, on the one hand, New York has been this laboratory. We've seen a ton of success for progressive socialists of different kinds. On the other hand, if you look at presidential voting in New York, outside of South Texas, no county has shifted more right since 2012, 2016 than like Queens and the Bronx, actually, right? They're still pretty blue, but not nearly as they were before. And it's partly because, like, you know, a lot of people, if they're sick of losing the argument to progressives in the center left coalition, just exit that coalition. They may or may not join the Republican coalition, but they may just not vote in primaries and things like that. And they'll be hard to reach in things that aren't polls, right? I mean, even polls are not hard to reach, but like in activist movements, they aren't well represented, but they may actually vote as kind of not a silent majority, but like a silent and important, sometimes like swing faction.
And one of the things I think that we're dancing around here that both Jerusalem and Nate alluded to, but we're just in a time of kind of ideological upheaval where the old factions, the old kind of coalitions are breaking apart in some respects, and there are new coalitions being formed. You can see this in kind of the, you know, the rise of the post-liberal right with J.D. Vance and what you mentioned, Jerusalem. But what's interesting is you also see that on the left, that, you know, Chris Murphy is yelling at you on Twitter because he also wants to have a cult of the common good. He just wants Chris Murphy's version of the common good rather than J.D. Vance. It's very funny to me that Chris Murphy, who has been in a years long quest to kind of be an intellectual leader of the Democratic Party, has settled on the idea that like that J.D. Vance fella has some good ideas and that's the bet he's going to make. But you see that. You also see, you know, the Israel issue is interesting. Nate alluded to this, where there are people who are very pro-Israel, perhaps leaving the Democratic Party to just vote Republican. But you also see the Republican Party with a sharply increased skepticism of Israel, that there are a lot of just part of it is just straight up anti-Semites in the Republican Party now. But the rise of isolationism there, the idea that we should just not be involved, is growing over time on the right. And I think what we're seeing, the larger thing to undergird all of this, is just coalitions are falling apart and there are going to be new party systems that emerge in the next 5 to 10 years. And, you know, it's unclear where liberalism and capitalism are going to fall in this new system.
So I want to skip all the way to question 8 because we can't do all 12. So we have to start cherry picking a little bit here. So you ask, you know, should the center left regard the DSA left as a threat to liberal values? When you look at polling, Nate, like what do people who support DSA, what do they believe?
Like in some ways, DSA support is more correlated with kind of age, income, and education levels, right? So it went kind of viral when I kind of published an article saying the DSA is for highly educated but downwardly mobile voters. Now, people have pointed out a corrective, which is, you know, sometimes downwardly mobile might be people who have not been upwardly mobile because they're young and have a lot of debt and have never earned a lot of income. But like, but, you know, that's a big definitional principle there, I think. You know, I think within the DSA, I mean, we've talked a lot about AOC. AOC in some ways is an anti-establishment. In some ways, though, she is quite partisan, right? She and Bernie backed Joe Biden after the debate in 2020, kind of vocally. During the shutdown, I thought she was a quite effective messenger around healthcare for Democrats and things like that. Like her, you know, I don't think her party loyalty scores are that low, actually, right? She often is pragmatic in how she's going about voting things. You also have a burn it all down faction of the DSA left, right? I guess, you know, just because he came up in the Twitter feed, like, you know, when like Matt Stoller, this is very in the weeds, very online, but he was like, yeah, Mark Carney is way worse. Carney, the Prime Minister of Canada, is way worse than Trump. It's like, bro, what are you doing, man? I mean, like,
I just want to point out that you just defined for our audience who Mark Carney was, but not who Matt Stoller was, which is possibly more online than anyone has ever been. Matt Stoller is an economic populist who's the head of this think tank, and we will put the tweet on the screen. But like Nate said, you know, yeah, he said that Mark Carney was a bigger threat to what is it, autocracy? He's a bigger autocratic threat than Trump.
He said
was.
He's an autocrat and much worse than Trump. Which I didn't agree with.
I respect his commitment to the bit of the only thing that matters in the world is anti-monopoly policy, and I will literally refuse to care about anything else in the world. He's at least very consistent about it.
But I do think there, by the way, there are interesting coalitions between, maybe the DSA left is too polarizing, between the left and the center on like city governance issues, right? Because like the way California is the perfect epitome. And I was just in LA. Like, every time I fly into California, I'm like, this is the most fucking beautiful piece of land in the world. Like, I know California is doing really well, but like California should have twice as many people and be five times wealthier. And then you're trying to get like the shuttle bus to the Uber facility at LAX, right? And it takes like 40 fucking minutes in this supposed paradise. And like California is an example of because you have entrenched, sometimes corrupt, unelectable, that was a bad phraseology, but like, you know, it's not a competitive system in the general election, right? That leadership is failing. And like, I think like in New York has some principle. I think New York is much more functional than LA or San Francisco, certainly. But you know, I like this little coalition between the left and the center that you kind of have in New York City now, where Zoran has been pragmatic in a lot of ways. You know, I was on the fence about him. I voted for a write-in candidate, but I would probably endorse his re-election now, because like I mostly care about practical shit. Like, does the subway work and is the trash picked up and are they spending money well trying to build more housing? And like, I think he's been effective on those things by not being a Matt Stoller ideological type.
So, I mean, I think this goes back to the question of like the establishment, right? Because I mean, what you have in as places have stopped being electorally competitive, you know, whole cities, whole states are governed by this kind of like blue establishment by definition. And the nature of an establishment is to not be that ideological, is to be transactional. And that has meant in a lot of blue states, this kind of like soft degrowth corruption. Right. And so if you want to displace that kind of corrupt establishment, you need something. And the authentic views of the people in New York City and California are very, very, very culturally left wing. It's like super cosmopolitan people, et cetera. And so like what you have to work with is a kind of diffuse left energy. And I might like prefer, if I could draw up on my whiteboard, a like return to Dick Reardon, Rudy Giuliani. Like you were saying, Nate, I think everything should be like it was in the 90s. You used to have these very culturally liberal Republicans running in big city elections and winning on a program of like crime is bad and we should try to have like some discipline over what we spend money on. And that's like very sensible. But it seems like what worked in New York and might work for Nithya Raman in LA is something more like a kind of a sewer socialist left. Although in San Francisco, you have a like conventionally moderate reformist mayor winning. So like many things are possible, but like I really do think like if the center left wants to have any future, it has to lose this kind of addiction to the establishment sense of being in charge. And that like, we have to like admit to ourselves that like we have in fact lost a lot of sway over the Democratic Party, that it's not 1997, and that like a feisty leftist taking over might not be the end of the world, that like we have our own ideas and our views and our things, and like we think they are correct, and we think that people who want to address the problems of New York City or wherever else are like gonna have to pick up some of these ideas, but that we're not gonna like fight to the bitter end for the personal prerogative of Karen Bass or Andrew Cuomo or Kamala Harris to like remain in charge perpetually, because that has no value unless your being in charge means you're delivering. And they've like stopped, like the Democratic establishment stopped some time ago, like really being a like reformist center left liberal force. And it's just become this kind of like goo that nobody likes.
I mean, to me, like the question of the DSA is like, which direction do they choose? Because there's like I said, like you can have liberal and illiberal versions of basically almost like any part of the spectrum. And you guys have talked a little bit about like the more liberal stuff around like sewer socialism. But I mean, like the real concern is what Nate was saying at the very top, which is that there is a sensibility among extremists that people who disagree with you are either corrupt, stupid, manipulated, or lying. And if that is the fundamental kind of politics that they bring, rather than the Zoran Mamdani, I'm just trying to fix, you know, the subway energy, then that will be, I think, an existential threat to liberal values. Like, I think that, like, if it's the case that they are, you know, returning to, I don't really know what people mean by woke one was crazy, exactly what they're talking about. But if what they mean is we're returning to a time period where we are, you know, carving out friends and enemies in advance, and then we're going to just destroy our enemies no matter what they say or do, and our friends can do no wrong, and we're not really evaluating things on the merits, like that will be a huge threat. And like, I just think it's like genuinely unclear, because in some ways the DSA is now becoming almost like a real party in some respects. You see these like huge intercoalitional fights going on about, you know, whether they should be more electoralist or whether they should, you know, really stick to their guns on certain really extreme issues. Some of these factions are putting out like statements that like other factions are disavowing. So it's like just who wins out there seems like also like a separate question.
And for me, I think one big question is not about the current Democratic establishment, but about political parties in general. You know, personally, I think, I don't know how you fiat it or whether it's exogenous or endogenous, but you know, I would prefer parties to be weaker. I think there are lots of subtle things that privilege the two-party system in the US. You know, I'm a big fan of these ranked choice voting. I'm a big fan of like these four-way primaries like you have in Alaska. If not for that, then Lisa Murkowski would be replaced by a conservative Republican and or by Mary Peltola. So that, I guess, is kind of a toss up potentially. But like saying, okay, people, you definitely have more than two big ideological clusters, but having mechanisms where, you know, like in California, you would think in like an efficient market, quote unquote, that you would have like the California centrist party, which doesn't compete in national politics, but maybe you have coalitions of like, but is an alternative that is the right relative to the Democratic Party of California, right? And actually nominates more effective leaders, right? There's not much of that. And one thing that's happened is that as politics has gotten more nationalized, and importantly, as media has gotten more nationalized, then like people's image of the Democratic Party is based on the national party and not the fact that New York State Democrats once used to be quite liberal in some ways, and California Republicans once used to be kind of reasonable in certain ways, although California's always been very complicated. That local party character has been all but abandoned now. And, you know, one of the few throwbacks to it, Susan Collins, is a 70% chance to lose her seat, according to the Silver Bulletin forecast.
All right. Well, Nate, Jeremiah, thanks for coming on the pod. This has been fantastic. We didn't go through all the questions, but people can do that themselves by going to Silver Bulletin. We'll put it in the show notes.
Thanks so much, Jerusalem.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Great. Well, if you're listening right now, we're going to do a segment on peer review. So stay tuned.
Hey, everybody. Lady Luck here. And we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Okay, here we go. We are back with our peer review segment. This is where we'd like to talk about some new or sometimes not totally new research. And you've got a cool paper for us today. You want to tell us about
it? I have a paper that made me very happy. This is not that new, but it's new to me. It came out December 2025 by Marie-Pascal Grimon and Christopher Mills. And basically, these researchers did it's called Better Together, a field experiment on human algorithm interaction in child protection. So there was basically a randomized control trial of roughly 4,600 children. And the algorithm is providing support to CPS workers that are looking at investigations. And what they find is that with the CPS, human AI augmented interaction, you end up seeing a 21% decrease in child injury admission. So workers are still making the decisions. The robot's not making the decision. The algorithm is just providing them information. And the workers are now making better decisions as a result of that kind of AI augmentation. And they reallocate investigations towards children at greater likelihood of harm. And this just seems nice. Like, everyone's really worried about AI replacing us and about us losing our meaning and purpose in life. And like, the best case scenario is that AI tools help us do our jobs better and make the world a better place. And so this made me very happy, Matt. I don't know what your reaction to this paper was. I bet it was doom and gloom.
No, I mean, it's not sadness. Doom and gloom. I just, it's great. This is great. It's good. We're doing great. I suspect that there will be a lot of findings of this sort over the next few years, and that there will be a lot of attention paid to them. And, you know, there was a moment in the rise of chess computers when they were getting better and better. And then eventually we had a computer that was good enough to beat a human grandmaster. And people were like, man, it's over. But then it turned out that, like, actually a human player collaborating with a chess computer could be even better than a chess computer on its own. And it's like, we're so back. And then a few years later, like, the computers just got better again. And like, it's
just better. Finish that story, and chess is still more popular than ever.
No, it's not that chess isn't popular. No. I just mean, like, the arc of computer progress. Like, I 100% believe this result, that, like, the computer-informed human is doing better than a human that's following the algorithm blindly. Mm-hmm. But I also believe enough in computers that they will be able to learn from this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, see what it is the human judgment is adding and actually become better than the human. Then I think the most significant part of the finding is just the fact that, like, the unaided human judgment is, like, actually, like, pretty bad.
Yeah.
And can be improved a lot with the computer algorithm. And that algorithm can be improved now with, like, extra human judgment. But, like, well, we'll see. It seems like the humans, you know, as people have suspected, are, like, kind of biased in their decision making around these child protective service calls.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that was interesting is the biases seem to go in both directions. So essentially, you know, it wasn't that CPS was now investigating more. Workers were now reallocating the investigations they were doing in a more effective direction. What you see is that there are low risk Black children that are investigated at much higher rates than they should be. And like, the AI tool helps the workers realize that and kind of direct away. But one thing that's interesting is the AI tool itself was biased towards over surveillance of Hispanic and low income families. And so the human was able to correct for that bias too. And so like there were like two separate biases, one from the AI, one from the human, that worked in different directions. And the human enabled with the AI score was able to make a better, less biased decision overall. And I mean, I agree that like, you know, probably the case will be at some point that an AI can, you know, system can learn off of these interactions over and over again. And hopefully we'll be able to, you know, give scores that are like less and less biased over time. But I also just think that like some, it's like, I just don't really think like, there's new information that pops up in the world all the time. There are like new arrangements that show up that disadvantage or advantage different kinds of people. And there are different ways for systems to be biased. Just like if even if you imagine these as super intelligent minds, like that doesn't mean like perfect. And so like, can humans still retain some kind of value in that kind of arrangement? Seems important. But even if it is the case that, right, that like the AI technology is able to direct exactly where investigations should go, that doesn't actually take the human out of the equation at all still. And like, I know that you're not, you know, maybe you are saying that, but I don't know if you're actually saying that, but I do think the case that like in case like CPS, like I really do think people are going to want like human interaction involved in like CPS investigations, like a robot sending you like a digital message or even like a robot physically showing up at your house to like do an investigation by itself. I think it's just like not going to be the vibe.
Probably. I mean, you know,
like robot cops seems,
I guess like,
well, I don't know.
Well, but I mean, like, I think we already have like these questions around like automation and policing and algorithms, right? And like, there's a
They won't even let us do the fucking cameras. We can't even do fit cameras, you know?
Well, I mean, and it's I have always thought it was very interesting that there's a lot of left skepticism of like surveillance cameras as a law enforcement tactic, as part of a kind of like a comprehensive left view that you shouldn't punish crime, but that like conservatives,
or concerns about privacy.
Well, but that conservatives specifically seem like much more worried about cameras than about human police officers, and to be uncharitable. I always thought like one of my favorite pieces of journalism like ever was this piece Dara Lind did for us at Vox, I think probably over 10 years ago now. But she was pointing out that like in experimental settings, when you told people that the criminal justice system is racially biased, that this causes African-Americans to become like more skeptical, but white people to become more enthusiastic. And so like on net, you're like increasing support for law enforcement because, you know, if people think that there's a trade-off between like privacy and security, but then you're like guaranteeing them that like all of the downside of that trade-off will be concentrated on people who belong to an ethnic group that they don't belong to, and they also get the security benefits, then they're like, that's great, right? And if you come up with something that's more neutral, like just traffic cameras, then you like actually get more civil libertarian instincts from white people. Civil libertarian instincts that I do not share personally, but like depending on how you look at it, right?
Are you not more concerned? I used to be like very like much less concerned about privacy in general, but with like the surprising rise of AI capabilities and coupled with seeming like the potential for you know, we're just removing almost all like liberal procedural constraints as fast as possible. Like it seems like quite bad to give government the power that this level of surveillance would give them.
No, I don't agree. I mean, this is a different podcast, but like, I think that like, you know, the world that we have now, where we've like surrendered all of our privacy to commercial entities, but continue to make like blind the state, is like quite bad. And like very, like it's very annoying to me how challenging it is to prove to DC public schools that I live where I live, when like on some level, like A, like Google knows where I live, Apple knows where I live, Amazon knows where I live, and like also other government agencies, like they deliver the mail to my house, but like the government is not allowed to communicate with the government about where it is that people live.
Yeah, I mean, like I agree that like state capacity, like is that something that we should all care about, and like making it easier for government agencies to talk to each other and share information is good, but like that's also like you know, like how fascist states end up enacting terrible policies. You know what I mean? It's like pretty easy to target people.
This is like, I remember I was in Germany and I was like having lunch with this guy.
Yeah.
And I was like, I tried to check this place out and like, I couldn't see it on Google Street View. And he's like, well, we don't have Google Street View here. And I was like, why? And he's like, well, if you understood the history of this country, you know, you would know. And I was like, I don't think actually that Hitler needed Google Street View. Like, I'm pretty sure that's not the history of your country at all.
Okay. That is what we call a straw man in action, Matthew.
I stand by it. Like thinking back to the CPS thing, it's just like providing a richer set of information allowed the algorithms to judge people less on these like crude racial heuristics.
Well,
and
like also
generated
more
a better outcome.
Like the algorithm.
Well, I don't understand what was going on with the Latino families.
I don't know. I think it might have been an income thing, but it was income and Hispanic. It was significantly more Hispanic and SNAP recipient low income children than human workers would have. And those extra investigations were not accompanied by better health outcomes for those groups. So the disparity is like not like warranted.
No. I mean, I understand, but this was just really one where it's like I wanna understand more like what is causing it to have that,
I don't know,
view of Hispanic families in particular. Because I mean, you could, I mean, I don't know. It, like also like, why can't you just fix it? Why can't you just tell
them
like,
sure.
Like put +7 for for Latino families and the outcome. I mean,
we need to bring like an actual ML engineer in here to explain to us how any of this functions.
Okay, let me posit. Oftentimes, if you hear about the income level of a given family, you know, you draw certain inferences of like what it's like. But then actually, if it turns out that family are first generation immigrants, you have to like readjust your sense of what's going on, because obviously people who don't speak English face like labor market disadvantages that among native English speakers, poor labor market outcomes are associated with all kinds of other like cognitive attributes. Mm-hmm. Whereas like, if your problem is just that you don't speak English, like that's going to make you poorer than you otherwise might be without having any of the other kind of deficits, right? Because whenever somebody's low income, like there's like some reason why.
Yeah.
And those reasons correlate with other things. And like understanding it correctly in like a socially sophisticated way leads you to have a better understanding of like what's actually going on. I mean, I don't know.
My limited understanding about how you train machine learning models is that like doing very crude +7s, as you put it, is actually like can mess up a lot of stuff. Like the whole, like there's a whole world of reinforcement learning from human feedback. And like the whole point is that like the after you've trained the model on a, you know, all the corpus of text that exists in all of humanity, you then have like feedback from human training, often like from Nigeria and like India or whatever, that are like then giving you like, yes, no, you did this right, you did this wrong, etc. And like, I think they're like, again, I don't understand this, and probably we shouldn't just posit like randomly on this podcast about it. But like, my machines like if they were just like, yeah, don't be biased to black people, and you could just do that without fucking up the entire model, I'm sure they would.
No, right. But I mean, that is why I was like ultimately think that the algorithm will supersede the team, because you should be able to do this reinforcement learning.
Yeah.
Where like right now, humans are providing like an important corrective to the algorithmic decision making, but at least like a good machine learning algorithm will learn from those corrections and come to incorporate it.
I don't know. I think there are biases, even like really, really, really good frontier models right now. Like I see biases pop up in these models all the time. I'm not seeing racial biases all the time, but like, you know, right now the current Claude model is really irritating to me because it like it really defaults to finding flaws in things that there aren't flaws in. So like if you send it something that's like very like simple, it'll go like, well, did you know like this? And it's like, and I'm like, I don't think that's wrong. It's like, you're right. I was just looking for something to be wrong. And I'm like, you know, I just think like it's a mind. Just like, I mean, it's super intelligent and it's like much smarter and faster than me and has a lot more information. It's like not the exact same thing as a person, but like I would expect that no matter how good these minds get, there will still be biases to correct for.
I think it's worth saying, right? Like, at least as I understand it, this is not like actually like using like frontier artificial intelligence.
No.
Right? This was some kind of simpler algorithmic yes. decision
yeah.
making.
Yeah.
You know, so the sort of thesis of this paper, which I do think is important, is that we should probably be incorporating some more algorithmic work into our evaluations. I think like this is probably really important in sentencing and parole, mm-hmm. which are like two areas where we right now have like very consequential decisions being made with like a lot of human discretion and a big kind of around like who are the humans exercising that discretion? Like who is checking whether they're exercising that discretion well?
Yeah.
What are the incentives and biases that are kind of facing them? Like it's a real kind of like, you know, dark matter of the American criminal justice system.
I mean, CPS is like super unpopular in like all directions. It's like they're either over enforcing or under enforcing. And like, I mean, I at some level, like you feel bad for them because it's an agency where like you really can't do it right. Like if you are over investigating someone, you're really violating someone's home. Like it's an extremely traumatic thing to go through like a real CPS investigation and like feel like your family's under a microscope. I mean, Pete Buttigieg had this recently happen where they separated him from his children because of it was clearly like a swatting type thing where someone had, you know, called in a false report. And like, that's like horrible, right? To have that happen to you. But then like, if something goes wrong in a family and CPS wasn't, you know, as intensive as they could have been, that also creates huge problems. And so like you would hope that like algorithms would help out here. But I actually don't think you can solve this problem with just algorithms unless you get a level of data from people that I would find like extremely concerning for the government to have.
Well, I think it's not like well understood how widespread CPS investigations are. They said yours is like 37% of children, like at some point,
yes.
come under CPS surveillance, not necessarily like intervention.
And but, more than 50% of Black children. It's crazy.
Right. Because, I mean, how do I put it? Anytime something goes horribly wrong,
yeah,
you look back and you're like, man, somebody should have said something.
Yeah.
Right. And so then we create these like new mandatory reporter classes. So people are raising these red flags, but you have this kind of, like Bayes' law sort of issue, right? Where like instances of like suboptimal parenting are, I'm sure, like quite widespread,
yeah.
but instances of parenting that is so bad that it would like actually be better to yank a child out of the parent's home is quite, quite rare.
Yeah.
So when you focus on those cases where in retrospect you wish there had been an intervention, you find sure there's like all kinds of red flags. But like how red are those flags actually, right? Like they're often, I would say a lot of these flags are like, you know, like pretty pink or like very, it's just.
I mean, it's like really hard. Like there are a lot of parenting failures where I could like view them as like horrible and even abusive, but it still is not the best thing for someone to be taken out of the home. Like separating a kid from their house and from their parents to go into a foster care situation where they also may not be in a good situation. Like you have to be like really certain that it's like the worst possible case for that kid to remain there.
But then that becomes like a tough.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
if you're like something gets flagged by a mandatory reporter and then you look into it and you're like, ugh. This
yeah.
is like a 20th percentile home environment.
Yeah.
But to then just be like, okay, but like, would it be constructive to actually intervene?
Yeah.
Like, maybe not.
Well, this began as something where I was really happy and uplifted, and it ended on a very sad and difficult note. So I think that that's a great place for us to close out. I think this is our longest ever podcast, but we had you know, four people talking in the first bit, so I think we should feel good about that. We are reading The Road to Serfdom for our book club, so that'll be our next episode. If you want to pick it up, if you have some questions you want us to interact with, this is our first right-wing book that we're reading on this podcast. The others have been mostly on the left. So read along with us and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit spinquest.com for more details.